Hello, everyone. This is Peace Radio with Sally Perrine and Joe Wagner and myself, Joe Maxwell. And we have quite a good show lined up for you today.
Lots of protest stuff.
Yeah.
Occupy various places. Occupy Moscow. Occupy Wall Street, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then info from the Occupy
the local
DC as well, which started October 6th.
Mm-hmm. So to begin with, we have headlines. The first is that Yemen's president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, has announced that he will meet anti-government protesters' demands and leave power in the coming days. Unfortunately, opposition leaders remain skeptical. Quote, I reject power and I will continue to reject it and I will be leaving power in coming days, the veteran leader said on Saturday in a televised speech during which he launched a tirade against his opponents. Saleh said it was, quote, impossible to let them destroy the country, whereas there were sincere men, whether they be military or civilian, who were capable of governing Yemen. Anti-government protesters have been camped at Freedom Square in the capital, Sana'a, for nearly 9 months, demanding that Saleh step down after 33 years in power. Tawakkul Karman, Yemeni activist and recent Nobel Peace Prize laureate, told Al Jazeera that protesters are skeptical of Saleh's announcement, as he had promised to step down in the past but had not. Quote, he has to hand over the power. He has to give the power that he has stolen to the revolution people. The revolution rule. We don't believe him, she said, adding, quote, we are continuing our peaceful revolution. After President Saleh's announcement on Saturday, Tariq El-Shami, Deputy Minister of Information, told Al Jazeera Arabic that what the president meant is that he would resign under the framework of the Gulf Initiative, which means he will stay in power until elections are held. Alarmed by the nation's escalating unrest, Yemen's wealthy Gulf neighbors have been trying for months to persuade Saleh to accept the initiative, under which he would hand over power in return for a promise of immunity from prosecution. The Occupy Wall Street movement that began in New York last month with a few people has expanded to protests in more than a dozen cities. They included Tampa, Florida, Trenton and Jersey City, New Jersey, Philadelphia and Norfolk, Virginia. To the east, to Chicago and St. Louis in the Midwest, Houston, San Antonio, and Austin in Texas, Nashville, Tennessee, and Portland, Oregon, Seattle, and Los Angeles in the west. And as we said, here in Moscow.
And
Spokane.
And Moscow, Spokane, Denver, Missoula.
Yeah. And in Missoula?
Boise.
Yes.
Idaho
Boise.
Falls.
Portland.
Mm-hmm. So it's spreading. Dallas Federal Reserve President Richard Fisher surprised a business group in Fort Worth, Texas on Thursday when he said, quote, I am somewhat sympathetic. That will shock you. The Fed played a key role in one of the protest targets, the 2008 Wall Street bailout that critics say left banks enjoy huge profits while average Americans suffered high unemployment and job insecurity. We have too many people out of work, Fisher continued, saying, quote, we have a very uneven distribution of income. We have a very frustrated people, and I can understand their frustration. In addition to the bailout, protesters have raged against corporate greed and influence over American life, the gap between rich and poor and hapless, corrupt politicians. Quote, I'm fed up with the government. I'm fed up with the bailouts. If I fail at my job, I don't get a bonus. I get fired, said Tim Lucas, 49, vice president of a software company who was protesting in Austin. Hundreds of people have been arrested in New York since the protests began last month. On Wednesday last week, the biggest crowd so far of about 5,000 people marched on New York's financial district, and police used pepper spray on some protesters. Mm-hmm. But protests, for the most part, have been nonviolent. In related news, a report released on Tuesday revealed that 10 major U.S. corporations, including big banks, Citigroup, and Bank of America, laid off workers after enjoying a tax holiday in 2004-2005 that had been billed as a form of economic stimulus.
It's hard to imagine why people are actually angry at that.
I know, because I enjoyed my tax holiday. Oh, wait.
With large multinational companies pressing Congress for another tax holiday, the Institute for Policy Studies reported that the last one did not fulfill its rosy promises for hundreds of thousands of U.S. workers. 58 corporations that accounted for 70% of overseas profits repatriated under the 2004-2005 tax break collectively saved $64 billion in taxes. Then they cut 600,000 jobs through layoffs, the report said.
Saving how many more billion in salary?
Yeah, yeah. It is the latest in a series of warring studies on whether U.S. multinationals should be allowed, for the second time, to bring home hundreds of billions of dollars in overseas profit at a bargain basement tax rate. Large companies are lobbying again for such a tax break, which would let them repatriate much, if not all, of an estimated $1.5 trillion in overseas profits for well below the 35% corporate income tax rate. Legislation in the Republican-controlled U.S. House of Representatives would let them repatriate those profits at a mere 5.25%.
That's outrageous.
That's outrageous.
5% it should be.
Why should they pay 5%? Why? They're rich. They're better than us.
That's right. They should get it for free.
Yes.
The same tax rate given to them under a similar tax holiday during the Bush administration. Just as they are doing now, companies 6 years ago said that the repatriation tax break would boost jobs and the economy. Mm-hmm. But the Institute for Policy Studies said this did not happen, as earlier academic studies have also found.
That is such a surprise. Maybe this time it will work.
Yeah, maybe.
And after that, we can build a wall around the protesters.
Maybe they've had a
change
of heart.
Too.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. Awesome. And our last headline for this hour, Reuters is reporting that Nebraska Governor Dave Heineman has asked Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to reroute a proposed oil pipeline from Canada to Texas so that it avoids crossing a major underground aquifer in his state. In a letter to the State Department, Heineman said Clinton has the authority to change the route of the $7 billion Keystone Pipeline if it is in the national interest. The proposed route would cross the Ogallala Aquifer, a giant underground reservoir that touches eight states but is mostly under Nebraska. Critics say an oil leak could pollute the water supply of the Plain States.
It never leaks. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
The oil keeps the algae down.
Quote, rerouting the pipeline around the Ogallala Aquifer is in the national interest, Heineman said. Therefore, I request that Secretary Clinton use her permitting authority to change the route of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. The pipeline proposed by TransCanada would extend more than 1,600 miles from Alberta to Texas through Saskatchewan, Montana, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, and Oklahoma. It is designed to carry crude oil from Canada's rich oil sands deposits to Texas Gulf Coast refineries and reduce U.S. dependence on Middle East imports. But critics say the risk of an oil spill that could pollute the aquifer is too great. Hundreds of people converged on a small town in Nebraska last week to protest the proposed pipeline at a U.S. government hearing. Heineman also asked the State Department to clarify whether Nebraska has the authority to pass legislation to give the state the right to set the route of the pipeline. Several lawmakers in Nebraska have said they want the state legislature to pass such legislation, but it would require the governor calling a special session of the state legislature. The State Department, which concluded public hearings on the proposal last Friday, has the authority to approve or reject the proposal because the pipeline originates in a foreign country. And I think Obama has the ultimate authority over that, too, which is one of the reasons for the recent environmental protests that were in D.C. targeted at him. Now we have this clip from the recent testimony in D.C., and as a little background, supported by hundreds of people who believe that the American people don't need to destroy the planet in order to prosper, dozens spoke up against the construction of the Keystone Pipeline at a State Department hearing Friday. Speakers concerned by the threat tar sands oil poses to our nation and our planet included priests and ministers, Obama campaign volunteers, and Nebraska ranchers. In the audio that we're going to hear, Think Progress Green has excerpted statements from youth activists Ethan Nuss and Daniel Sims, indigenous leaders George Poitras and Deborah White Plume.
I've met her. She's awesome.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Cool. Friends of the Earth President Erica Pica, clean tech investor Brigadier General Stephen Anderson, and former pipeline inspector Mike Klink. So we're going to play that audio for you now.
Friend company using foreign materials to pump foreign oil through America's heartland. When we can do better with a homegrown vision of American energy, good union-paying jobs in our steel mills making wind turbines across the United States and creating those millions of jobs for my generation that we need. We can do it. We can make the United States a global leader. We can end our addiction to oil. It starts here. It starts today. And it starts with your decision by firmly coming out against and rejecting the Keystone XL pipeline.
This pipeline will set back the clock 25 years of energy development in this nation. It will delight our enemies. It comes down to a couple things, folks. CO2 emissions, clean water, and American blood. Stop this pipeline.
Please, if nothing else, before you decide on this, adopt quality standards. And I know that you may not have them right now, you think you don't, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does have them. Give them a chance to build something that's right, regulated, welding procedures, and maybe, just maybe, there won't be 14 leaks in the first year, one of the worst disasters of a pipeline in history. Thank you very much.
President Obama ran a campaign on trying to clean up Washington, D.C. and cleaning up the lobby process. It is clear that this process is failing his promise, it is failing the American people, and it is failing the environment, and it is failing our need globally to address climate change. This pipeline should and must be stopped.
And I want to challenge Secretary Clinton, President Obama, who I think has an ethical and moral obligation prior to making this determination of an approval, to visit the tar sands, to see the tar sands, to hear our people, and to listen to the many concerns and issues our people have. And so with that, I'm happy to be here with our indigenous brothers and sisters from both sides of the border to oppose this pipeline. Thank you.
Thank you. In 2006, one senator stated, saying that America is addicted to oil without following a real plan for energy independence is like admitting alcoholism and then skipping out on the 12-step program. It's not enough to identify the challenge, we have to meet it. That senator is now our president. State Department, today, if you feel the sense of urgency we feel, then you have no doubt the moral choice you must make. Either you will support the oligarchy and the oil industry, or you will stand up the American people, environmental, and civil rights justice. We're empowering you, the State Department, to deny the pipeline for the Keystone XL. Thank you.
Our Lakota prophecy tells us, when Mother Earth cries, we stand up and we fight for her, or she will die and we will die with her. So I ask everyone to remember, crying Earth, rise up. Rise up with Mother Earth. Rise up and say no, no to this pipeline, no to death, no, 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 no.
We love them.
Yes, we do. Lots of voices.
And I've heard Deborah speak on other things. She's always that fierce and powerful speaker.
Yeah, that's good. We need lots of those fierce and powerful voices.
Telephone rang one evening, my buddy called for me. Said the bankers all are leaving, you better come round and see. It's starting revelation, they robbed the nation blind. They're all down at the station, no banker left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find. They were all down at the station, no banker left behind. Called a meeting to the White House. They went one day. They was going to call on the president in a quiet and a sociable way. And the afternoon was sunny and the weather it was fine. They counted out our money and no banker was left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find. They were all down at the White House. No banker was left behind. Thank you. whistle blowing, it plays a happy tune. The conductor's calling all aboard, we'll be leaving soon. With champagne and shrimp cocktails, and that's not all you find. There's a $1 billion bonus and no banker left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find. When the train pulled out next morning, no banker was left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find. When the train pulled out next morning, no banker was left behind. Hallelujah, man.
That was Ry Cooder, No Banker Left Behind, from his new CD, Pull Up Some Dust and Sit Down. It's a gem of a CD. We'll play some more from that later on. We're going to talk a little bit about the Occupy Wall Street. As we said earlier, we are going to have a guest here at 2:30, Sarah Sundquist, who is one of the organizers. She and her mom actually co-organizing the local Moscow Occupy Moscow. I'm going to read a little bit from an article in... almost had an accident here. an article by Will Bunch, who was at the New York City occupation, and his article, What I Saw at the Revolution, was quite interesting. He writes, I attended my first revolution this week. I have to confess I was a little nervous as I walked closer to Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan, the epicenter for this once unimaginable American autumn. For one thing, I'd been tweeting and blogging about Occupy Wall Street since the second day of the protests, but the sad irony was that I hadn't yet journeyed the 100 miles north from my Philadelphia comfort zone to cover it myself. Now I'd successfully lobbied my editors at the Philadelphia Daily News to send me up here, but they loaded me down with the questions. What do the protesters want exactly? Why is this different from all the other left-wing protests? Why now? And be sure to write about all those fringe people, the Ron Paul fanatics and the bandana-wearing anarchists and whatnot. Of course, adding such stress is why God created editors, but I had my own personal worries. What if the naysayers were right, that this was just a half-baked and patchouli-scented fringe? I got called a hippie the other day at the local peace vigil, incidentally. Didn't have my patchouli.
Maybe you were just wearing unflattering pants.
Almost certainly, yes. Not the vanguard of a movement to take back American democracy from a corporate oligarchy. It didn't help that as I walked from the subway station up Wall Street, already looking like a boulevard of broken American dreams with odd trapezoid-shaped roadblocks strewn across cobblestones and clusters of anxious cops on every corner, the first protest I could see in the distance read, Nazi bankers. The funny thing, and I mean that in the literal sense, was that later in the day, that Nazi banker dude muttering some other insanity was followed around Zuccotti Park by two guys with their own arrow-pointing signs that read, Not Us, and This Does Not Represent Us. By then, I'd been at Occupy Wall Street for a couple of hours, and there was plenty of time to know that the crazy Nazi banker guy surely didn't represent them, and also that the type of out-there anarchy-worshipping whack jobs that my editors back home had imagined were in short supply, to the extent that they were in short supply, to the extent that they existed at all. Instead, I spent most of the afternoon talking to Americans like Nathan Lewis, who came to Occupy Wall Street 8 years after he occupied Iraq. He says, that's when I started to wake up. Lewis, now 29, saying his time in the Persian Gulf made him realize that he was protecting a corporate empire overseas, and not the American people. He protested the Iraq War after he left the Army and also started a small farm in the upstate New York town of Trumansburg. His current frame of mind mirrored most of the folks that I talked to in Zuccotti Park. He told me that, quote, since Obama was elected, I pretty much lost all hope in the two-party system. And so a couple of days back, he hopped on a bus for New York City, and he hoped to stay here for another day or two because that was all he could afford. In the meantime, Lewis, thin and intensely serious, in a green fatigue-style jacket, was almost a bit embarrassed that his face was still painted a ghostly white, the remnant of a corporate zombie march that he had done earlier. But he wasn't embarrassed in the least to be at Occupy Wall Street, surrounded at all times by a few hundred like-minded souls. He said simply, I've been waiting for this day for years. That was a refrain I'd heard over and over again, voiced over the pounding backbeat of a nonstop drumline in the northeast corner of the park, that this was the moment that everyone here had dreamed would come eventually. I kept thinking about Barack Obama's famous pronouncement from the 2008 campaign that we are the ones we've been waiting for, except that it took another 3 years and that we seem to have left Barack Obama in the dust. Especially after he brought in his own Wall Streeters to run his financial plan. What was fascinating, though, was that for a few folks in the crowd, it was a day they were waiting for a second time after the Vietnam and civil rights protests of the 60s. Consider Dennis Gronham, a 61-year-old Brooklynite who took part in his first protest march in 1968. Now here he was in the bowels of Zuccotti Park with a long gray beard and looking a bit like Jerry Garcia. If the late Grateful Dead frontman had been resurrected in purple Crocs, strumming a blues riff and growling anti-banker lyrics while a 20-something pink-haired, punked-out woman spun to his music. Quote, they're doing what we did when we were their age, marveled Groman. Across the park, Peter Pinelli, a 20-year-old junior at Vermont's Marlborough College, only knows of 1960s protests from what he's seen on YouTube. But in a weird way, that is what inspired him to come all the way down to New York just this morning. He explained that the widely seen video of a high-ranking New York City police officer dousing two passive women already under arrest with pepper spray. If you haven't seen that, look that up. It's pretty startling. Women are caged in. In the orange sort of.
Completely not a threat.
I mean, just. Anyway, reminded him of a photo he'd once seen of a sheriff's deputy in Birmingham sicking a dog on civil rights protesters in 1963. And so now Pinelli is here, struggling to articulate the modern cause other than, I don't like how the political system is funded. Ah, yes, the question that my editors, and anyone who's ever worn a tie for longer than the duration of a funeral, is dying to know. What's the agenda? All these people camping out in a concrete park in soggy sleeping bags and now checking off the box for have you ever been arrested on those job applications that no one was actually reading anyway. If you come here to actually listen and not to heap scorn, you will get it. Sure, there's broad consensus for ending corporate personhood and getting their buckets of dollars out of the U.S. political system and for throwing the worst of the banksters in jail, but Occupy Wall Street and the sister movement springing up all across America is about something much more existential than one or two political issues. They are the other 99% who've been stripped bare of any real influence in a supposed democracy where both parties compete for the cash of the 1%ers. And so taking back their country starts with the simplest of steps, reoccupying America physically. I know this will sound weird, but I'm reminded of the salvation of the little people of Whoville. So desperate just to prove their existence that they chant at the top of their lungs, we're here, we're here. And what's so amazing is the way they've made here in Zuccotti Park into a real and thriving community in less than 3 weeks, not just with an orderly cafeteria line of free food, backed by donations from coast to coast, and you can actually get online and order pizza from the website, Occupy Wall Street website. But also a library of donated books to read during downtime. That's appealing to me. And a media center that gets electricity from God knows where. And their mini America grows in population and diversity every day. Disgruntled Iraq and Afghanistan vets, college students who see their debt clock ticking even as they're told it could be years before the economy creates jobs for them. Retired union guys and weekending farmers and people who started out with one issue like legalizing pot or ending the war and now see a much bigger picture coming into focus. They are the vanguard of the millions who felt certain during the low moments in the 2000s that the electoral system was the American exceptional way to cleanse the sins of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, only to learn that it was not hope, change, and a ballot box waiting behind the curtain on November 3, 2008, but a permanent government of hedge fund traders and CEOs. The Tea Party movement is a narrow group of mostly white, mostly middle class and mostly older Americans angry that the one party led by a man who didn't look like them won an election, commandeered and steered top-down by oil billionaires and the hucksters of right-wing media to help the other party win back control. Occupy Wall Street is a diverse bottom-up movement fueled by a loss of faith in both parties, and it is steered by no one, steaming into politically uncharted waters, which is what makes it all so thrilling. The symbolism of the place they've chosen to create an America's homage to Tahrir Square could not be more powerful. A tree-lined swatch of concrete that lies exactly at the short midway point between the two disaster zones that have defined our deeply troubled 21st century. The ground zero site of the 2001 terror attacks and the New York Stock Exchange that crashed and burned under attack from bankster shenanigans seven years later. Excuse me. Maybe that's why there's a gravitational pull here. So many of the people here in the park were drawn here by a force. And then he names a few people. Lizzie Durkin, who's 47, was 3,000 miles away in San Francisco, driving a taxi, selling baked goods, and occasionally demonstrating for gay rights when she learned about Occupy Wall Street on Facebook and packed her bags. In an oversized gray pinstripe suit, white painted face, dripping in mock blood, following the zombie march. She told me her story about getting arrested on the day of the pepper spray and how that only solidified our commitment to fight injustice. And at the end of the interview, she gave me a long hug, my reporter's notebook still clutched in my right hand. It is possible to feel many things after a day in Zuccotti Park, scorn perhaps if you're a big-time financial journalist, or a rapture of solidarity for everyday people. The only feeling that is not possible here is detachment. I'm here for as long as it takes for this revolution to take off, Lizzie Durkin told me. She has departed, but she knows she'll come back, as will I, says Will Bunch, the author of this essay. A few minutes later, I watched a banker type in his exquisitely tailored blue pinstriped suit turn to an equally well-attired acquaintance and mutter something about the protests maybe winding down in the winter when it starts getting cold.
Well, I think they're not allowed to have tents at the moment, right. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do about
sure,
that.
Sure, yeah. The rest of his words were drowned out by the throbbing beat of Zuccotti Park, a drum solo of the American soul with no end in sight.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
So who was the writer of that again?
His name is Will Bunch, and he's the author of a book about the Tea Party called The Backlash. Yeah. And he's also an editor for the Philadelphia Daily News.
We are going to now listen to a song by the Eels called I'm a Hummingbird, and when that's done, we'll have a discussion with one of the local organizers of Occupy Moscow.
The old oak tree had roots so far down in the ground. I fell from it and hit the dirt without a sound. I dreamt at night of growing wings so I could fly. A caterpillar to a moth before I die. I plodded through ordinarily earthbound. I knew my feet could never leave the ground. I went about my way unsteady and afraid. How could I know I was headed for this day? All the seconds and the minutes and the hours and the days and the weeks and the months and the years of my life. it was all worth it to be here now. I'm a hummingbird floating tree to tree. I'm a hummingbird, beautiful and free. The old oak tree was dead, I had to cut it down. The sapling roots were new and sprouting through the ground. New worlds were taking shape, unseen and unknown. A branch to rest upon, a place to call my own. Something had changed and I'm not sure how or why. I wasn't dreaming, I was awake, I was alive. Gave up the ghost, he had nothing left to say. But it was him who brought me to this day. All the seconds and the minutes and the hours and the days and the weeks and the months and the years of my life. It was all worth it to be here now. I'm a hummingbird floating tree to tree. I'm a hummingbird, beautiful and free.
So that was The Eels, I'm a Hummingbird. And now we have Sarah Sundquist here. Sarah, do you want to start by, I can't see you over the mic.
Sorry.
Just start by introducing yourself and I guess talking about what inspired you to start this Occupy Moscow with your mom, right?
Yeah. So I'm Sarah, and I was basically just inspired by all the movements that started springing up across the country, and I was following it all pretty closely. And just one day I was looking at all of the lists of places that were popping up, and I thought, you know, I wonder if there's anything going on in Moscow. And there wasn't that I could find. So, which kind of surprised me, and I thought that there definitely needed to be some sort of a presence here. So, my mom and I are pretty close, and I had posted just something on Facebook about if anyone wanted to start something as far as an Occupy Moscow group, and she replied, sure, I'm on board. And
that's nice.
And 2 days later, we had our first little meeting down in Friendship Square, and actually a lot more people showed up and seemed supportive, and were really excited that there was a group that was getting started here.
About how many are coming regularly? Or
Usually we've been doing from 4 to 7 every night in Friendship Square, and usually we have anywhere from, I would say, 5 is a low number and 20 is a high number. We did have kind of our first organizational meeting Friday night, and we had, I think, between 25 and 30 people attend to that. Good. Really impressed me. So
that was at Mikey's, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. You filled the back room with Mikey's.
We did, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So what did you decide at that meeting beyond the 4 to 7, 5 days or 6 days a week or whatever?
Mm-hmm. We're trying to keep everything as inclusive as possible. Mm-hmm. So we don't really want to have, you know, there's obviously some people that are able to be more involved than others. So we kind of delegated different tasks as far as people being in charge of internet media and people being in charge of things like radio and newspaper media in mm-hmm. town mm-hmm. and getting the word out to those various groups mm-hmm. of people, because mm-hmm. not everyone is on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Sort of delegating some tasks like that. We also kind of decided that our main goal is going to be to try to get people actively involved in on a local basis. Because obviously there's some pretty big ideas going on with the Occupy Wall Street movement, and We're going to just basically try and focus on how we can make a difference in our community where we are, because we all are students or working and have families. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty diverse group of people who have gotten involved to this point, and we can't all afford to go and be in New York, even though we'd like to. Right.
Well, there sure is a lot to do. And I was pleased to see people joining in with the peace vigil, because there's a place to of blend and shared.
Yeah, I think that I'm really impressed with the peace vigil that they've managed to keep that going for so long. And I think for 10 years is really impressive. So I think there's probably a lot that we can learn from that group as well.
Well, I think just joining forces, and I think just recognizing that the things that inspired the peace group, which were the two wars that are still going on 10 years later,
right,
are all tied in with the economy and and certainly the people that are fighting those wars are part of that 99. I mean, there's nobody in the 1%ers that are fighting the wars.
Right.
They're drawing from the poorest people, you know, certainly a lot of people in our communities here. So it's all tied in.
Yeah.
As well as with the Megalode.
Right. I was going to mention that too. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the peace group going on, the Megalode people, and that's all, you know, ties into the things that the Occupy movement is about. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all interested in social equality, environmental issues, and...
No, I'm sorry, you can only have one point. According to Fox News, you can have one point.
Otherwise, your message is muddled.
Unlike theirs. No, I think the point is sick of it. I really enjoyed seeing them, having traveled around the last week and seen them everywhere. So I was really pleased to find out there's one right here. And
yeah, I even had a girl come up to me at the market yesterday when we were downtown, and she was taking pictures of our booth, and she said, "I'm from New York. I'm going back in a couple days.
Cool.
I'm so excited you guys are doing this here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be on Wall Street when I get back, and I'm going to show this to all of my friends."
Oh,
I was like, you know,
excellent.
That's great.
And Jill, you were in Denver and Missoula, right?
Denver and Missoula, and then my nephew helped out with the Occupy Spokane on Friday. So it's everywhere.
Yeah, there's more. Coeur d'Alene's got a group going on now, too.
Boise.
So. And yeah, Boise has a pretty large group. So.
Idaho Falls, I think, does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
Shouldn't have left so many people unemployed. It gives
too
much free time.
Yeah.
All this cheap media, that was such a mistake. But no, it's really exciting to hear about it going on locally and, like I said, coordinating with all the other groups.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm excited about it, and I just hope that, you know, the people that are interested in it continue to grow. And by the response that we've gotten from just being downtown and talking to people has for the most part been positive. There's a lot of people that say, "Oh, I'm so glad that you're here and that somebody cares."
Right. So how can people help, or how can people get hold of you, for one thing? People that are listening, what are some of the ways to get hold of you? And
We do have a Facebook page, if that's something that anyone is on. It's facebook.com/OccupyMoscowID.
Okay.
And then we also have started a Google Groups page, if anyone is on that. We are going to be present in Friendship Square, so if not everyone has access to internet, then you can just come down and find us. Right. We're also going to try and post flyers when we're having bigger events. And I think some people have started already posting flyers just about what we have going on now.
And what days, again, are you at Friendship Square?
For sure, Monday through Friday from 4 to 7.
And this afternoon?
Yes, we'll have a group of us out there this afternoon as well from 4 to 7. So.
Wow, good.
So, and... we also have people that are trying to get more notice as far as the university communities. Mm-hmm. And we've met quite a few people from Pullman that came to the market yesterday. So I'm hoping at some point we can work with the Pullman community as well. And, and
they don't have one yet, do they? Occupy Pullman.
No, not think. As far as I know. So hopefully we can get some people over there interested, because we're all pretty close.
Yeah, right. Actually, yesterday was a really good day to be present at the market, because it was a
homecoming
big day. Because of homecoming.
Yeah.
So
Do you have your next meeting planned already?
Yes, we do. Our next meeting is going to be on Monday from 6 to 8. And that'll
and
be...
And Mikey's again?
Actually, it's going to be in the conference room at Almond Plaza, which is 200 Almond Street.
Is that where Panhandle Bread is? That plaza?
No, it's... sorry, it's I believe it's South Almond.
Oh, okay.
It's there's a two-story concrete building that is just what is it? It's close to kind of behind where there's a tattoo parlor there, I think.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
It's a building behind that.
Jill knows where the tattoo parlors are. It was a strip joint, she knows. So is there anything your group needs?
We basically need people to who can show up.
We need bodies at this point.
Yeah,
right.
We need bodies. We need we've gotten a lot of people who say that they support our cause, which is great. We appreciate that, but we really want to try and get people involved. So the more people that can come to, not only come to the meetings, but actually have an active presence is what we need, because we're eventually going to get organized enough to have some local events that we will need help with, in specifically just trying to help members of our community, because I think what is especially important to this local group that we've got going on is helping the people here now where we can help and make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So. Nice. In your conversations with people who've been part of the protests, who've been actively involved, what are some of the concerns, some of the themes that keep popping up?
Well, underemployment is a big thing. There are generally a good amount of jobs available in Moscow, but a lot of people have college degrees that they're not using, or have families to support and have to work two or three jobs to be able to support their families.
Either underemployment or overemployment.
Right,
people
yeah.
People exhausted because they're piecing together, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So
healthcare, I suspect, is another
healthcare
big one.
Is definitely another big issue that a lot of people are concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also say just... there's a general consensus of wanting to shift more focus towards the ideas of supporting local businesses and
so that ties in with Shop Local too.
Mm-hmm.
That group. I mean, it's all. I think if we start making these connections and these webs with buy local.
That seems to be one of the things that's happening in New York, too, with the unions joining with the students, and the nurses were out, and just diverse groups of people finally coming together, like they did in Seattle for the anti-globalization protests.
Right.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you, really, for making the initiative and occupying Moscow.
Yeah, I'm just glad. You know, as soon as I set it up, I got a lot of quick responses that were like, "Oh, I'm so glad somebody's doing this." You know, which is great. That's what we need is support and enthusiasm and getting people involved, I think, in their local community and what's going on at
and,
that level.
And the fact that people are willing to do it more than once. I mean, you know, it's not just a one-time protest and then you go away, but it's a visible
just
presence
ongoing.
Every
yeah.
day, like the peace vigil. I mean, it's just an everyday reminder that something is wrong.
Yeah, I think oftentimes what I started getting frustrated with was everyone's complacency towards what was going on, myself included. It was kind of just a building thing in myself that I just felt like I needed to do something about. And you know, just finally got to the point, you know, there's enough other support going on around the country. I thought that we'd probably be able to make something happen here.
Yeah, it reaches a point of where I think we're starting to talk to each other, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I love, across the generations, across the different, different issues. Environmental and economic justice and war and peace.
And one of the great things, too, is that it's not the same old people protesting. It's the youth, and it's a bunch of new faces, and, you know, I think that is really cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, keep us posted. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks
I appreciate it.
Even more time out of your
life. Schedule. Yeah,
no problem. I appreciate you guys having me.
Now we will listen to another Rye Cooter song.
Number 13.
And do you know the title?
Not offhand.
It is, let's see, If There Is a God?
Mm-hmm.
All righty, here we go.
Republicans changed the lock on the heaven door. Keys of the kingdom don't fit no more. Poor working man like me and you, if we ain't got money, we won't get through. There's a God, I think he's got to bottle up and go. If there's still a God in heaven, he's got to hit that lonesome road. No more Jesus, mind you, you done past heaven, built tents everywhere. Restricted signs everywhere you go. I think they want to bring back old Jim Crow. There's a God, think he's got to bottle up and go. If there's still a God in heaven, he's got to hit that lonesome road. Gabriel said it won't be long. Republic land is a getting strong. The heaven folks are feeling bad. Lose everything that we ever had. If you're brown, you can't hang around. If you're black, better step way back. If you're red, I think you're better off dead. If you're poor and white, you just ain't right. If there's a God, I think he's got to bottle up and go. And if there's a God in the heaven to pay, I think he's got to hit that lonesome road. And there's a God, I think he's got to bottle up and go. If there's a God in heaven, hitting that lonesome road. Down by the highway side, trying to play a ride. Don't know that it seems to know him no more.
That was Rye Cooter, If There Is a God.
Wonderful Rye Cooter, doing all the instrumentals except for the drums, which were done by his son, guitar, mandolin, bass. If there's a God, there's a God in heaven, he's got to hit that lonesome road. Because the Republicans, the first line, Republicans changed the lock on heaven's door. Keys to the kingdom don't fit no more. The poor working man like you and me, if we ain't got money, we won't get through. I messed up the rhyme there, but anyway, just this great CD, Pull Up Some Dust and Sit Down, Rye Cooter.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry's listening to this one. We're going to finish this hour with just a part of an essay that Naomi Klein, a speech that she gave on Wall Street, and unfortunately on the when the speakers, they're not allowed to have
no
mics.
Amplification.
Yep. Right.
So they say half a sentence and then people yell it and passes it on. And so she wrote this up. This is what she would have said if she'd been able to do the full speech.
Mm-hmm.
And she started with, I love you. She said, I was honored to be invited to speak. Since amplification is disgracefully banned and everything I say will have to be repeated by hundreds of people so others can hear, What I actually say at Liberty Plaza will have to be very short. With this in mind, here is a longer, uncut version of the speech. And so she starts with, "I love you." And then she said, "And I didn't say that, just say that so that hundreds of you would shout, 'I love you back.'" So that is obviously a bonus feature of the human microphone. "Say unto others what you would have them say unto you, only way louder." Yesterday, one of the speakers at the labor rally said, "We found each other." And that's, I think, what mm-hmm. we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. that we're finding each other, the peace people, the environmental people, the megalodes people. They were finding each other. We're starting to connect. That sentiment captures the beauty of what is being created here, a wide open space, as well as an idea so big it can't be contained by any space. For all of the people who want a better world to find each other, we are so grateful. Naomi Klein, if you're not familiar with her, is the author of No Logo earlier. She wrote that mm-hmm. when she was, I think, in her 20s probably.
Mm-hmm.
And then The Shock Doctrine,
mm-hmm.
which was really a description of what is happening worldwide of people in power either taking advantage of a disaster and then mm-hmm. using that to push their agenda, or creating a disaster, which is what happened in 2008, really,
mm-hmm.
was a
mm-hmm.
created disaster. And that's, you know, was used to take more control and mm-hmm. more, you know. So anyway, mm-hmm. she's been just an amazing thinker and one of the people that I think, you know, is mm-hmm. good to follow. She's also really cute. So, YouTuber, she's... If there's one thing I know, it is that the 1% loves a crisis. When people are panicked and desperate and no one seems to know what to do, that is the ideal time to push through their wish list of pro-corporate policies, privatizing education and Social Security, slashing public services, getting rid of the last constraints on corporate power. Amidst the economic crisis, this is happening the world over. And there's only one thing that can block this tactic, and fortunately, it's a very big thing, the 99%, that's us. And that 99% is taken to the streets from Madison to Madrid to Moscow to say, "No, we will not pay for your crisis." That slogan began in Italy in 2008. It ricocheted to Greece and France and Ireland, and finally it has made its way to the square mile where the crisis began. "Why are you protesting?" ask the baffled pundits on TV. Meanwhile, the rest of the world asks, "What took you so long? We've been wondering when you were going to show up." And most of all, welcome. Many people have drawn parallels between Occupy Wall Street and the so-called anti-globalization protests that came to world attention in Seattle in 1999. That was the last time a global, youth-led, decentralized movement took direct aim at corporate power. Sorry, I'm losing my voice here. And I'm proud to have been part of what we call the movement of movements. Anyway, she's talking about the 1999 event in Seattle. But she said one of the differences is that Occupy Wall Street has chosen a fixed target and put no end date on the presence, which is wise. Only when you stay put can you grow roots.
Mm-hmm.
This is crucial. It is a fact of the information age that too many movements spring up like beautiful flowers but quickly die off. It's because they don't have roots, and they don't have long-term plans for how they're going to sustain themselves. Being horizontal and deeply democratic is wonderful. But these principles are compatible with the hard work of building structures and institutions that are sturdy enough to weather the storms ahead. I have great faith that this will happen. Are you on there too?
Do you want me to help you?
Yes, please.
It's fun listening to you gag. Something else the movement is doing right? You have committed yourselves to nonviolence. You refuse to give the media images of broken windows, street fights, and the tremendous discipline of this has meant that again and again, the story has been the disgraceful and unprovoked police brutality. The biggest difference a decade makes is that in 1999, we were taking on capitalism at the peak of an economic boom. Unemployment was low, stock portfolios were bulging, the media was drunk on easy money. Back then it was all about startups, not shutdowns. We pointed out that the deregulation behind the frenzy came at a price. It was damaging to labor, it was damaging to the environment, corporations were becoming more powerful in government, and it was damaging democracies. To be honest with you, while the good times rolled, taking an economic system based on greed was a tough sell in rich countries. 10 years later, it seems as if there aren't any more rich countries, just a whole lot of rich people.
Mm-hmm.
People who got rich looting the public wealth, exhausting natural resources. The point is, today everyone can see that the system is deeply unjust and out of control. Unfettered greed trashed the economy. It is trashing the natural world as well. We are overfishing the ocean, polluting our water with fracking and deep water drilling, turning the dirtiest forms of energy on the planet, like Alberta tar, turning to the dirtiest forms of energy like the Alberta tar sands. The atmosphere cannot absorb the amount of carbon we're putting into it, creating dangerous global warming. The new normal is serious disaster, both economic and ecological. These are the facts on the ground. They are blatant. They are obvious. It is easier to connect with the public than it was in 1999 and to build this movement quickly. We all know, or at least sense, that the world is upside down. We act as if there is no end to what is actually finite, fossil fuel, the atmospheric space to absorb the emissions. We act as if there are strict and immovable limits to what is actually bountiful, financial resources to build the kind of society we need. The task of this time is to turn this around, challenge this false scarcity, to insist that we can build a decent, inclusive society, at the same time respect the real limits to what the Earth can take. What climate change means is that we have to do this on a deadline. This is, this time our movement cannot get distracted, divided, burned out, or swept away by events. This time we have to succeed. And I'm not talking about regulating the banks and increasing the taxes on the rich, though we need to do that. I'm talking about changing the underlying values that govern society. This is hard to fit in.
That's, I mean, that's hard.
Sally's back.
Yeah, I'm back. I have my voice again. But I like that. You know, when I read that before, changing the underlying values that govern our society, the values that we used to have of care for.
I think a lot of the 99% still have.
Oh, right. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm saying we as...
Yeah. It's the values that govern, not the values that exist that need to change.
Right. Okay, go on.
Okay. You can burst in again.
I'll burst in it.
It is hard to fit into the single media-friendly demand. It's hard to figure out how to do it. But it is no less urgent for being difficult. That is what I am seeing in this square, in the way that you are feeding each other, keeping each other warm, sharing information, providing healthcare, meditation classes, and empowerment training. My favorite sign here says, "I care about you." In a culture that trains people to avoid each other's gaze, to say, "Let them die," this is a deeply radical statement.
Mm-hmm. I
love it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wish we had video. Sally's doing a modern dance of her emotions. A few final thoughts in this great struggle. Here are some things that don't matter. What we wear. Whether we shake our fists or make peace signs. Whether we can fit our dreams for a better world into a media soundbite. And here are a few things that do matter. Our courage, our moral compass, and how we treat each other. We have picked a fight with the most powerful economic and political forces on the planet. That's frightening. And as this movement grows from strength to strength, it will get more frightening. Always be aware that there will be a temptation to shift to smaller targets, like, say, the person sitting next to you. After all, that battle's easier to win. Don't give in to that temptation. I'm not saying don't call each other on things. But this time, let's treat each other as if we plan to work side by side and struggle for many, many years to come, because that is the task and that demands nothing less. Let's treat this beautiful movement as if it's the most important thing in the world, because it is. It really is.
Wonderful Naomi Klein.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So.
Yeah. And now a little Steve Earle, America version 6.0, the best we can do. Peace. that was Steve Earle, America version 6.0, the best we can do. And now time for the second hour's worth of headlines. To begin with, declaring women's rights vital for world peace, the Nobel Committee awarded its annual Nobel Peace Prize on Friday to three indomitable campaigners against war and oppression, a Yemeni and two Liberians, including that country's president. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Africa's first freely elected female head of state, shared the $1.5 million prize with compatriot Lima Gabawi, who led a sex strike among her efforts against Liberia's civil war, and Arab activist Tawuko Carmen, who hailed the award as a victory for democracy in Yemen. Quote, "We cannot achieve democracy and lasting peace in the world unless women obtain the same opportunities as men to influence developments at all levels of society," said Norwegian Nobel Committee chairperson Thorbjørn Jagland. Johnson Sirleaf, 72, and once dubbed the Iron Lady by opponents, is currently running for a second term in an election on Tuesday where she faces criticism for not having done enough to heal the divisions of years of civil war. Jagland dismissed suggestions that that the award might seem to be meddling in the vote. But the former Norwegian prime minister said that honoring Yemen's protesters, who, unlike those in Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya, are still battling to get rid of their ruler, sent a signal from Oslo that President Ali Abdullah Saleh, long a U.S. ally, and other Arab autocrats should now step down. "It is a message that the era of Arab dictators was over," Carmen told Reuters in Sana'a, declaring her prize a victory for Yemen and for all of the uprisings of the Arab Spring. The trio of laureates follow only a dozen other women among 85 men, as well as a number of organizations, to have won the prize over its 110-year history. The committee said it hoped the three-way award will help to bring an end to the suppression of women that still occurs in many countries, and to realize the great potential for democracy and peace that women can represent.
Mm-hmm. And I was especially glad to see that since Wangari Maathai died just last month.
And was she last year's winner? No, 2 years ago.
A couple years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In other news, a computer virus has infected the cockpits of America's Predator and Reaper drones, logging pilots every keystroke as they remotely fly missions over Afghanistan and other war zones. The virus, first detected nearly 2 weeks ago by the military's host-based security system, has not prevented pilots at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada from flying their missions overseas, nor have there been any confirmed incidents of classified information being lost or sent to an outside source. But the virus has resisted multiple efforts to remove it from Creech's computers, network security specialists say. And the infection underscores the ongoing security risks in what has become the U.S. military's most important weapons system. Quote, "We keep wiping it off and it keeps coming back," says a source familiar with the network infection, one of three that told Danger Room about the virus. Quote, "We think it's benign, but we just don't know. Military network security specialists aren't sure whether the virus and its so-called keylogger payload were introduced intentionally or by accident. It may be a common piece of malware that just happened to make its way into these sensitive networks. The specialists don't know exactly how far the virus has spread, but they are sure that the infection has hit both classified and unclassified machines at Creech. That raises the possibility, at least, that secret data may have been captured by the keylogger and then transmitted over the public internet to someone outside the military chain of command. Drones have become America's tool of choice in both its conventional and shadow wars, allowing U.S. forces to attack targets and spy on its foes without risking American lives. Since President Obama assumed office, a fleet of approximately 30 CIA-directed drones have hit targets in Pakistan more than 230 times. All told, these drones have killed more than 2,000 suspected militants and civilians, according to the Washington Post. More than 150 additional Predator and Reaper drones under U.S. Air Force control watch over the fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq. American military drones struck 92 times in Libya between mid-April and late August. And late last month, an American drone killed terrorist Anwar al-Awlaki, part of an escalating unmanned air assault in the Horn of Africa and southern Arabian Peninsula. And for our final headline comes this bit of news from Washington. Toy giant Mattel, the company behind Barbie, announced on Friday that it will stop buying paper and packaging linked to rainforest destruction following a global campaign by Greenpeace. As part of its new commitment, Mattel is instructing its suppliers to avoid wood fiber from companies, quote, that are known to be involved in deforestation. One such company is the notorious Asia Pulp and Paper Group, which Greenpeace investors and investigators have shown to be involved in widespread rainforest clearance in Indonesia. Responding to the news, Bustar Matar, head of Greenpeace's campaign to save the forest in Indonesia, said, quote, "The rainforests of Indonesia should be for species like the Sumatran tiger, not for throwaway toy packaging." That's why it's so good that Mattel has developed a new paper buying policy. Quote, "This is more evidence for Asia Pulp and Paper that rainforest destruction is bad for business. Golden Agri Resources, a sister company to APP, has already committed to clean up its act and has won back lucrative contracts. Now APP must do the same. Using a combination of research and forensic testing, Greenpeace investigators showed that packaging for the Mattel toys was being produced using timber from the rainforest of Indonesia, home to endangered species. Greenpeace activists dressed as Ken dolls assembled in front of Mattel's headquarters in Los Angeles in June, hanging a giant banner which read, quote, "Barbie, it's over. I don't date girls that are into deforestation." Mattel's new policy also includes safeguards against buying wood fiber from tree plantations established in areas where natural forests once stood. The conversion of rainforest to pulp tree plantations is a leading driver of deforestation in Indonesia. Their policy also aims to increase the amount of recycled paper used in their business, as well as to boost the use of wood products certified by the Forest Stewardship Council. Indonesia has one of the fastest rates of forest destruction in the world. The Indonesian government estimates that more than 1 million hectares of rainforest are being lost every year. So that's cool, and that's a clear victory by Greenpeace. So,
yay.
Proving you can have an influence if you just try.
Even on Barbie.
Even on Barbie. And now a Mary Chapin Carpenter song.
Got over her.